From LA Times Studios, you're listening to The Real, all things entertainment. I'm Mark Olson. I write about movies for the Los Angeles Times, but we're here today to talk about Scandal, the popular television show that is having its series finale. And joining me today from the television desk, we have
Lorraine Ali, television critic.
Yvonne Vieira, television reporter.
Mary McNamara, assistant managing editor, arts and entertainment, and former television critic.
Yvonne, maybe to get things started, you can tell me a little bit about, I know you just recently kind of visited the set of the show as they were shooting some of their final episodes and even sat down for a sort of an extra-sized round table. You had like just about everybody from the cast was there.
At their actual round table.
Actual round table. I went mid-March, and it was the last week of filming. So they were filming the series finale. And it was so weird, like, to approach the set, which is on the Sunset Gower lot. I was approaching, and Tony Goldwyn, who plays Fitz, was just riding around in a scooter, like the Kick scooter, just on the lot. Like, no big deal. But, yeah, I got them during their lunch break. We were all around the table.
All right, everyone, this is Yvonne from LA Times.
When we were doing the photo shoot, it was interesting. Like, they were chronicling everything that's happening. They were shooting selfies and taking video. Like, you could tell there was a sense of, okay, we're approaching the end. Let's take stock of everything.
And now, did you feel that they were over it? Like, are they happy? Like, are they kind of, like, glad they're going to be free of the show soon? It seems like the people involved in this show have a very particular emotional attachment to these characters and to this show.
I think it was a bittersweet moment. I don't know if they're over it, but I think they're sort of content with it also being done. They don't want to overstay their welcome is something I heard a lot. They're glad to be going out before things got too crazy. But yeah, it was a sense of Katie Lowe's was talking about how she's been the one that is making everyone remember or look back at where they began. Like, she was very nostalgic about everything right now.
I know, Mary, when the show first came on the air, it only had a 7-episode order. And what has made this show special? Why do you think Scandal has sort of caught on with audiences the way that it has?
Well, when Scandal came out, it was received with like kind of meh reviews. It was because it was a very different show than it is now. It was much more toned down. It was sort of like almost a case of the week. It was very procedural. It was about this fixer in Washington, D.C. that is based on an actual fixer in Washington, D.C. People were excited about Kerry Washington and people liked the kind of ensemble, but it just felt very like sort of familiar, even though the sort of milieu was different. You know, so then Shonda and Kerry, I guess, sort of got the idea that they were going to, Shonda, first she was going to up the octane level and the like sort of crazy level of the scripts. And then this idea of live tweeting, of engaging on social media, of just drumming up business for the East Coast, for the West Coast, of just really being this huge presence on Twitter. Now, Shonda had been an early user of sort of audience engagement, even on like the ABC website. She would blog. She would respond to people. She would get a little sassy about like if people criticized her for something that went on in Grays. She would like sort of go, you know, I'm not here to make your dreams come true. I'm just here to write the best television show I can. And so she, you know, that was a natural transition for her. And it was huge. And the only show that had previously done it with that kind of success was Pretty Little Liars, which had a very female base, a very young base. And that transitioned kind of naturally to Scandal, which started off with a very female base, a little on the younger side. And so then you had like this thing where people were having a Twitter conversation while the show was going on. And then you had people who were then watching it in real time. So not only did you have a show that was kind of becoming more exciting as a show, you also had a show that was suddenly getting talked about everywhere because it was sort of refreshing this notion of appointment television. And then you saw everybody.
The copycats.
Everybody's live tweeting. Everybody's tweeting from the set. Any showrunner that had told anybody to ever put down a phone was like saying, pick up those phones. And you also saw like this idea of that every episode had to have like an oh my God moment. And that you saw spreading all across television. It was, the show itself. As a critic, before I stopped being a critic, it was crazy and it didn't make any sense sometimes. And you had like these crazy things happening, but it really did. It shook up the industry and just made people realize, oh, these are things you can do.
I think it's so ironic that this is when it's ending. So, you know, we're talking about it was crazy. You know, you couldn't believe some of the stuff that was
going on.
A fixer, affairs in Washington, right. A rigged election.
A sitting president killing a Supreme Court justice.
Exactly. Yeah. And now is the time when it goes, when we're closing. It's like, as you said before, things got too crazy, which makes me laugh because it's like, well, actually, everything outside of it now has gotten so crazy that I don't know that there's anything it could do to, like, ramp it up the way it had.
But how do you compete with it is a thing, I guess.
I don't know that you do. I think you move out of the White House and you right. go somewhere else.
Right. That's true. I mean, because, like, Veep, like, Julie Louis-Dreyfus famously said, oh, we're sorry, we started making a satire and now we turned in, we've made a documentary. But Scandal right. is actually closer because it's just, like, that whipsaw and, like, things and people moving and changing jobs and getting fired. And even when you're watching it, you go, oh, this could never happen. And now we're like turning on CNN and going, oh, yeah, I guess it can.
They knew.
Lorraine, tell me a little bit more just about this idea of appointment television, that there was a point at which maybe people, you know, because we're all watching things now, time shifted on whatever devices we may be watching them on. The idea of like a show actually bringing audiences back to watching things, you know, at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock on a Thursday. Is that just good for the industry or do you think that somehow was good for the show too?
I think it's just something culturally that people really want. These touchstones where we can all sort of connect on one thing. I mean, if you think of kind of about Roseanne or something like that, that kind of still has that appeal. It's like, okay, there's something where we all come together or a live event. It's harder and harder to come by. And I think for that reason, culturally, it was really important. In terms of the industry, I'm not so sure. I mean, I think what I see as the show's great legacy is just diversifying television. I mean, being on the front end of it, I think she was the first Black female lead in a network drama in almost 40 years.
Was it since Julia?
Since Get Christy Love.
Get Christy Love.
That's okay. Astounding.
That is horrifying.
And if you look in its path, how much has changed, and I'm not saying that was the show that did it, but it certainly was on the front end of
that. Pushed open doors, yeah.
Well, Shonda was certainly.
I mean, yes, right.
She doesn't like to talk about it sometimes because I think she's had to talk about it so much, which must be super irritating. But, I mean, she famously did that with Grey's Anatomy when just said, why are you just bringing me white people? I can't cast a show just from white people. And that became, you know, sadly a hallmark of a Shonda Rhimes show. And now you're seeing it finally. And it took, what, 10 years to sort of, especially in these big ensembles, you need to like really represent what the United States of America looks like. Never mind checking boxes. It's like, make it look like, you know, what a city looks like. If you're going to have a city hospital, you know, make it look like what a city hospital looks like.
Yvonne, can you talk a little bit about what it's kind of meant to have the emergence of Shonda Rhimes and the way in which she owns a whole night of network television with three shows on in a single night. What does that kind of mean for her as a creator? And then also with the sort of cultural products that she's creating and the vision of America that she suddenly is a dominant force of network television.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing the rise of these sort of mega producers where before it would be like no one really knew who ran a show. And now the showrunners are, in a lot of cases, the stars themselves. So it does, it's sort of, you like come in knowing a little bit of what you're getting when it's a Shonda show, you know what I mean? And so I think that sort of helps in sort of marketing these shows of, okay, I know what I'm going to get. It's going to be something that has me at the edge of my seat and I'm going to want to watch this. And I think that's why she is like a hot commodity. Who wouldn't want to be in business with somebody that has not only like a relationship with viewers, but can deliver a lot of times on what she's putting forward.
Mary, you actually interviewed Shonda Rhimes sort of before Scandal,
yes.
And it was just for Grey's?
Well, I interviewed her. I was one of the first people who interviewed her when Grey's had just started because I loved it, like, from the first episode. And I was like, this is going to be a big hit. And then it was. And, you know, which my track record is not, like, 100%. But anyway. So what had struck me, not just that she was a woman of color, which at the time, running a room, still, unfortunately, was unusual, but also she had a writer's room that was 50% female, which was unheard of, is still not usual, but was at that point, I think she was the only one. I interviewed her sort of looking at that and then went and talked to the writer's room. And But I was just, she's a presence, you know, and she's very confident, even when she's talking about how unconfident she is. I'm like, if I could talk about how unconfident I am as confidently as you are, I would be okay. But, you know, and she did. And she just sort of like stood her ground. I think that that's what she's, because she was like, she had never run a show before. She had like gotten this job based on Princess Diaries and a couple of movies. And Mark Gordon was her, and Betsy Beers was there too in the beginning. But Mark Gordon supported her to say, as a young person who'd never run a show, bring me different people. I'm not doing this. I mean, that's kind of really brave and crazy. It's hard to think of another person who could do that, certainly at that time. And even now, I think it's difficult. Think about like what Yvonne was talking about, like the showrunner, the rise of the super producer. You know, we had like Norman Lear and John Wells. People did know, but now people know a lot more. But most of them still are like on cable, either premium or on the streamers or whatever. And there's a difference between like, and we just went through this thing where Shonda went to Netflix and then Ryan Murphy went to Netflix. That's a different thing because, I mean, Ryan did Glee. He's been doing FX, which is like a 12-episode order. You know, the shows that Shonda's, I mean, how many episodes of television has that woman either, you know, written or overseen or helped produce? It's like millions, I think. Well, probably thousands, but it's a lot.
But do you think it was with Scandal in particular that she kind of really found her footing and Shonda found Shonda in the sense of the way the storytelling has become so amplified and that so much happens in an episode and it really that elevated, amplified sense of storytelling? Did that really come out of Scandal or had she already been doing that?
Grace got a little crazy for a while, but that sort of fast-talking, almost Aaron Sorkin-ish kind of like rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat, that was very Scandal, and that was very based in D.C., and I think that she spoke about that in your piece about how that was sort of what these characters were about. The twists and turns, I mean, yeah, I think that did sort of amp up television in general, because that was not true of Grey's or Private Practice, where you had these crazy, you know, what's going to happen next every single episode.
And I think that was also critical at that time for network TV, because, you know, you've got all these cable series that are kind of kicking its butt. Then you have streaming coming in. And it's almost like you needed something to compete with that. And it did. And it has. And that's often not the case when you look at that dynamic.
Yvonne, can you give me some sense? You know, as I was doing a little bit of reading about the show, and it seems like part of that audience engagement, this idea of the gladiators and white hats and even the drinking a little wine while you're watching the show, is that stuff that, again, that audience engagement stuff part of what's made it so popular? And maybe for you, what do some of those things mean?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, I know when it first started, I was sort of like, okay, I like it. It's fine. But yeah, it wasn't until the second season that things really sort of like, whoa, what is happening with the storytelling? Like, this has me hooked. And it was one of those things where you didn't want to come into work and be the one that hadn't seen the episode the night before. You'd be damned if somebody spoiled something for you. So it's kind of like, I need to watch. Not only looking at Twitter and seeing what people are responding to, am I responding to the same things in the same way? But also, like, I'm texting friends and colleagues, like, are you watching this? Like, this is insane, and I can't stop, and I want this to happen. I hope this happens. It really brings people together. And it was fun. You could communicate with somebody like on the other side of the country, like you're interacting over a show. You rarely get that.
It does seem like the way that, let's say, Kerry Washington has emerged as such a star from the show, that it's like she has almost, I don't know, she's taking on some Olivia Pope-ish qualities herself. Like, she seemed really empowered by this character to sort of grow herself as a personality in like the media sphere.
It's funny because I often have a problem separating her from Olivia, you know, and now that you say that, I'm like, wait, who lent what to who? I know it sounds incredibly unprofessional of me, but it's like, no, she is Olivia. I don't know. That's funny.
Well, she's number one on the call sheet. You develop a sense of leadership when taking on a role like that. And she's actually the one that suggested that they live tweet the show.
Shonda was somebody who engaged on social media in a great way. I was on social media because I have a friend, Allison Peters, who's a social media consultant, but also one of my best friends from high school. And she had convinced me to go on Twitter. And I came across an article before we aired that was like, these were the most buzzed about shows on social media. And because we had a small order, our first season, not a full season, it was 7 episodes, and I thought, well, maybe that would help us. Like, I want to be one of those shows. And she said, well, then probably everybody should. I feel like I've told this story a million times. But she said probably everybody on the show should live tweet, but I didn't want to be like the bossy lead actor. So I said, Shonda, what if everybody on the show live tweeted? She said, yes!
And I'd had the experience on Grey's where we had sort of logged every episode.
Oh,
and back in the days,
know,
we
logged. Yeah.
And people were like
cool.
really intense and insane about it. And so we knew that there was engagement there anyway. And so told everybody to get on Twitter, and they got on Twitter, and then the press got on Twitter with us, which was the most interesting part. And sort of followed along and had conversations, and then Oprah got on Twitter with us. And it just got really intense.
When did you guys feel comfortable with it, each of you?
I'm still
not comfortable.
Well, see, I was coming from rotary phone. it took a little while.
It was fun, though. We were together whenever we were doing together. It would be so much fun.
It was fun.
It really came from this feeling of, like, you know, there was all this language around the show being a risk for ABC because there was a black woman as the lead. And you know, I had spent months and months on the road with the Obama campaign in the first election, and so much of that first election, especially, was won through social media. And this feeling of, like, what can we do? We used to do live chats with all the Scandal sisters, and we used to, like, whatever we could do to kind of say, thank you, ABC, for this opportunity, and we're going to try to create a grassroots movement to outshine your expectation. And then the reaction floored us all, because it was way beyond anything that we could have imagined.
And it was almost instantaneous. Like, I was terrified of Twitter. I thought, I never want to ever have to, it just is, what's wrong with our society is that you express yourself in 147 characters or whatever. But in the very first time, seeing people react immediately, and there are thousands of people initially and eventually like millions, the impact of it was so clear to me. It was scary because I thought, why would anybody be interested in random thought that I have to say? But it's incredible. I just was blown away by the power of it. And every week was more and more and more and more.
And then also, what has it meant for both in the show and then maybe in a broader sense, the relationship that the show has between Olivia Pope and Fitz, is that the president? President Fitz? And as played by Tony Goldwyn, and it's been like an interesting sort of will-they-won't-they dynamic between the two of them and what audiences thought of it. Mary, what do you think that dynamic and that relationship has meant both for the show and maybe culturally?
I want to go back to what Yvonne was saying about it being fun. I think it wasn't an accident that it sort of occurred on still the upward arc of this prestige television and the golden age of television, when everybody was writing these literary theses about Mad Men and Breaking Bad and, like, just really serious, and which was great. We were taking television seriously as an art form. On the other hand, I think people were forgetting that it's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be entertainment. It's supposed to be something that you, like, gossip about and that you project yourself onto the characters. So I think, you know, with the love affair, I mean, that goes back to the American president. It's like, what is the ultimate dream date? The president. And so now you have, you know, this idea.
Not anymore.
Remember, we were in the Obama administration. But it's like... All right.
But also, like, the morality of it, because he's a married man. It was like a weird thing to root
for. Imagine
that.
Well, it was very weird. I mean, the whole thing was very weird. The idea that she was wearing a white hat was very weird, because some of the things that she did or, like, signed off on were not white hat-ish. But I also think, you know, you had the racial issue because he's white and she's black. They didn't say anything about it. And then they did, like, finally. It was like in the second season. And I think that it was, people had complained about the fact that this was not even being addressed, that wasn't an issue, and in what America do you live where this wouldn't be an issue? And so they finally did, like, sort of address it. But it's a soap opera, and it was like you rooted for the person that you liked even when they were doing really awful things. They did awful things on that show.
There's a lot of face licking.
Huck like cut people up, man. I mean, the body count on Scandal was pretty damn high.
It's high. Yeah. But at the same time, in between all the larger-than-life storytelling, they did tackle some serious issues. It did win a Peabody. It talked about serious things like police brutality, election rigging, in between all that, too. And that's sort of a signature of Shonda's storytelling.
With Grey's, you know, there's a continuation and a deepening of here's what I believe, here's how I grew up, here's what I want to happen, if I can get wishes turned into reality, of you are gay and you are straight and you are brown and you are yellow and you are black and you are white. And the commonality of humans is much more important than our differences. I'm not ignoring our differences. We'll talk about those too. But that everybody's got a seat at this table. And that's kind of gigantic. A lot of us got to see, live or on YouTube, Shonda accept an award from Oprah Winfrey. And Shonda be able to say to Oprah, there are ways in which I couldn't imagine who I could become until I saw you. And it's so true that the power of storytelling and us being able to envision how things could be, you know, it's made us really proud to be part of that kind of inclusive vision.
I'll add too that I think one of the things that's unique and what I appreciate about the show is that it highlights individual truths and also universal truths and melts them together in a way that is accessible and recognizable to pretty much anybody watching it. At some point throughout the show, they connect to that individual thing that's true for them specifically. And then at some point in the show, it's connected to another universal truth that challenges that individual truth. So it's kind of like this propelling thing, like this flower that keeps blooming, that keeps shifting, that keeps shaping. So yeah, that's what I think the legacy is of the show and what I appreciate mostly about the show, and that's an attestment to you. Absolutely.
Yeah. I just want to add one more thing because it's the Los Angeles Times that, and we've been talking about it a lot lately, but I think in this town, there's a lot of talk about how poorly behaved people in this business are, in particular actors, but just how toxic these work environments can be. And one of the things that's most important to me walking away from this is that when we say we're a family, we're not pretending. Like, there is a level of respect and love in this community between the crew and the actors with each other and with the writers and just across all departments. It's how we have operated, and it's been so important because we spend 16 hours a day together at times. And for that to be, I can't imagine having done the past 7 seasons doing it in a toxic work environment. It would have destroyed us all rather than elevated us all. And we've all grown so much as people and as artists, and I don't know that that would have been possible if there had been some of the things that I hear about in other sets. But that's not to say that we're better than other sets. It's to say, like, we made it a priority in our culture. Mm-hmm. Like, we made decisions along the way, in various stages along the way, whether it was in our renegotiation process with each other, whether it was how we get into vans or don't get into vans, whether it was how we post pictures about each other. Like, we made conscious decisions along the way to establish a culture that was about respect.
No, it absolutely did. As Lorraine pointed out, it offered, it sort of prefaced what we are now experiencing.
Right. I mean, it was topical, but then as you're saying, it was fun.
It was fun.
And who doesn't need an outlet for... especially now. I mean, it's kind of sad that this is the end, because now, actually, you could use that outlet.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break.
Spoiler alert! This year's lineup is one for the books. The Los Angeles Times Festival of Books. There will be authors, chefs, celebrities, and a plot twist. Introducing New Story, featuring conversations with leaders in podcasting, VR, television, and music, plus a Vortex 360 dome, as well as interactive games and art. The festival is April 21st and 22nd at USC. More information is at latimes.com/festivalofbooks.
And we're back, and we're talking about the series finale of Scandal. I want to talk just a little bit about the difficulty of sort of wrapping up a whole series, the characters, the storylines. The series finale is a relatively new phenomenon in television in the sense that so many shows for so long would just get canceled and end, and now they really, there's this insistence that they wrap up the way that they do. Mary, for you, what do you think some of the biggest challenges of any series finale, but definitely wrapping up a show like Scandal might be?
Well, I think throughout TV, there have been series finales, but there hasn't been the importance put on it because people really will say after a finale, and maybe this started with Lost, but it's like all those hours of my life that I'll never get back because the finale wasn't good. And that's new. Again, that sort of goes into the whole thing about taking television seriously, which is great. But on the other hand, it's like, well, did you enjoy? Did you think about things? Did you learn anything? Did you have conversations? That should be part of it, too. And I think there have been very few universally agreed good finales. Like MASH had a good finale. 6 Feet Under had a good finale. But like Seinfeld's finale was possibly the worst show on television. I mean, it's just like there have been some really bad finales. For a show like Scandal, you know, there's that relationship between Olivia and Fitz where you would like to see some sort of closure. You'd also like to see some sort of closure for her. What's she going to do next? How does she? Because she spent a lot of the series, like she had a lot of moral ambiguity and a lot of swinging, who am I? And so you would like to see.
And she got darker near the end. Like,
yeah. And Shonda said to you, you know, that she was on a particular journey. So I guess you do want to see that she's different from the character that was in the beginning. You would like to think that it changed her in some way.
But Shonda was sort of up. She said she was sort of operating and I can't think about how people are going to respond to it. Because then it sort of handicaps you, like being so worried about, is everyone going to be happy? But she did say she was satisfied with how it came to a close. And that's what a lot of, obviously, the cast said, too. It was a satisfying ending.
I only know how to do one thing, and I always only know how to do one thing. Always only known how to do one thing, which is to just tell story. So if I am going to do this, you have to stay true to the story. I can't think about what the fans might want. I can't think about what my sister is yelling at me that she wants all the time. or what even feels like should happen. It's more about what feels right for the story and the characters that, you know, inside this world that we've been living in. And so to me, it was just about getting to the place where the characters who have been speaking to us are doing what they're supposed to do. And I'm very satisfied that we have done that and we have gotten to that place for everybody in the stories. You know, like, it feels very satisfying to me in that sense. So I've satisfied story, and I feel really good about that. So I'm not sure how it'll be taken, and I'm okay about that, too. Mm-hmm.
Was it one of those things, I know sometimes when I feel pressure on something, when I know it came, did it come to you, or was there a writer's block?
I don't believe in writer's block. Mm-hmm. Writer's block is an excuse for not writing. I decided I had to tell myself that or else I would never get anything done. It's where the characters were supposed to go, and you wait for the characters. You know, I always say the show's a collaboration. We write things, and then the actors do things, and then I watch it on film, and then that sort of helps me figure out where we're going next, because it's not the script that is the dictate, you know, that dictates what happens. It's the script plus the performances. But other than that, yeah, I feel like we made it. I don't know. I don't feel any pressure. I feel like if the audience has understood the story we've been telling thus far, then they will understand where we go. And I can't, you know, I never read the comments. So
which may be why we all feel a particular way. I mean, yes, there'll be a certain amount of nostalgia. There'll be a certain amount of missing what this is. But I don't know how it feels to me like no one in this room is like, oh, my God, it's going to be over. Because it is satisfying. Mm-hmm. Because this experience, and I have not been here as long as they have, but this experience has been so fulfilling in so many different ways that it's an easy thing. It's an easy thing to walk away from because of what we've accomplished here. It's a hard thing to walk away from because what we've become to one another. But at the same time, you know, you said it's denial. I don't think it's denial. I just think we're just flowing the way we have always flowed. And when it's over, yes, maybe there'll be that thing of, you know, going over the cliff because it's over. But that doesn't mean this is over.
But I do think shows like 6 Feet Under, Sopranos, Breaking Bad, they definitely raise the bar for endings, for the ending to be like some kind of not just closure, but something that you could hang on to. And one of those moments when many, many people would be talking about it. But if you think about Roseanne coming back and Will and Grace coming back, we were talking about it when they were coming back, and half of us couldn't even remember how they ended. It was like, what?
I did.
No. What?
Dan
no,
died.
Yes.
No, but I mean, it's
they
funny.
Resurrected
like these
him.
Long running series.
Waking up from a dream. Oh, that, you
okay.
remember that.
That was
stuff.
Absolutely the best
yes.
finale. I forgot about that. That was the best finale yes. ever. And you could only do it with Bob Newhart because mm-hmm. only he could sell it with that face.
Yeah, but there are those ones that like just are like seared in your memory.
But you're right. I mean, there are a lot of beloved series that we look back on and we think of being as good series, and they had sucky finales. And so.
Right. And often it can like color, you know, you forget about what it was like watching the series, and you're like, because Lost, it was like, what the.
But see, Lost also had the problem with the network screwing with the final images, so you didn't even know
what was
going
the,
on.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, when you say you don't care how people feel, well, because half the people will love it and half the people will hate it.
And the thing is, you'll know immediately. We will have proof as soon as it's over how people responded to it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And with that, we're going to wrap up today's talk about the finale of Scandal. Now, why don't you all tell everybody where they can find you on the internet there, Lorraine?
You can find me on Twitter at Lorraine Ollie.
You can find me at Mary Mac TV.
I'm going to spell mine because it's harder. It's at V like Victor, I-L-L-A-R-R-E-A-L-Y.
And you've been listening to The Real for the Los Angeles Times. I'm Mark Olson.